Today, we gather to consider where we've been and where we are and where we are going as we think about what it means to say, "She is like a mother to me." Our reading from the psalm said that in some way God is like a mother to me. And the psalmist imagines as if he or she could remember what it was like to be a weaned child. And of course, a weaned child is one who is no longer dependent on the mother's breast, is no longer held in the same way, no longer is vulnerable, but also, if we can identify with what it means, a child probably in the terrible twos, or as I said, the equally terrible threes, who has become somewhat independent, walking and talking a bit, running away from mom and learning that word that every two-year-old knows, which is no. But at the same time, never really wanting to be out of mom's sight, never wanting to be too far away, clinging to mom, being held by mom, being comforted by mom, as the 2 or 3 year old discovers all the bruises and knocks and hurts of life. So we are brought to an image of God in this psalm who is like a mother. Now we know, as Rita Gross, Jewish thinker, says, that God is neither male nor female, or anything in between. We can only talk about images of God. In fact, she says, to speak about God is among the most difficult and audacious thing that we humans do. And to address God is even more difficult. All the words we use are analogous, metaphorical, cannot be taken literally, and can never exhaust all the possible ways there would be to speak of God, as if we would ever have language that could really imagine God. Unfortunately, what God language often tells us is more about those who use the language than it does about God. Analogies and metaphors have a base. And for those who limit the images of God, for instance, to only male language, doesn't tell us much about God, but tells us a lot about that society and the religion that is exclusive. Exclusive male images of God, an androcentric model of humanity, eclipses women. And these are often automatic and potent in shaping and limiting our perceptions. Those who use the word he when describing God and would say, well, that's not really what I mean, but it becomes potent. It becomes a way of shaping and limiting where we think. And we can tell that because we are always startled when someone says, and God, she. As long as we are startled, it tells you how potent the image is of God as he. And so today, I want us to think about the idea that perhaps we should use many, 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 many images for God, realizing that the human imagination is just not big enough to encompass all the possible ways we might speak of God, because no matter what we say, it is inadequate. It is also important as we honor women today that we think about a few things that have been said in the past that have influenced thinking down to the present age. I want to mention St. Augustine, who lived in the 4th century, who said, "Man, but not woman, is made in the image of likeness of God." Now, my guess is this probably helped Augustine feel better about the woman he had lived with for years and with whom he had had a child and whom he had abandoned. Because if she was less than, how much easier it is. But 1,000 years later, Meister Eckhart, who was very interested in creation-centered theology, said this: "The reason Eve was said to be created from Adam's side was to demonstrate the absolute equality of woman to man. For Eckhart, dominant God is immanent in creation, permeates all being, is present in each and every human being." In fact, for Meister Eckhart, which helps us to think about how to talk about God, the flesh, the living flesh, is the very medium of divine communication. How else would God communicate with us except through our very being? So, a few images about God. A former nun, who later became a mother, was asked if pregnancy and birth brought her closer to the divine. And she said this, and right in line with Meister Eckhart, "The whole universe is a miracle. The idea of an infant developing in you being a special mystery. Well, that's no more wonderful than it would be developing in somebody else, some other woman, or the little kitten in the mama cat. Why can't we become ecstatic over developing life, period? We're constantly participating in it, whether we're pregnant or not. Human imagination, seeing in new life all the possibilities of creation, whether male or female." So as I thought about that lesson, I thought, oh yes, we can think of God in so many ways, including our God as mother. But this is Mother's Day after all, and as I thought about the scriptures, I particularly liked this story from Exodus. It's an incredible story in that we're told that by the time that of this time, the Pharaoh of Egypt had forgotten all about Joseph, and the promise made to Abraham had become true, and that the Israelite people had become very numerous. So numerous, in fact, that the Egyptian Pharaoh was worried. And so he decreed, first of all, that they would become part of the forced labor of Egypt, which was very common, that they would often make people work in forced labor. But that was not enough. Soon the people were enslaved. And yet, the Israelites became more numerous. And so the Pharaoh decided that every newborn baby boy would be put to death, drowned in the Nile. Now the women decide to resist this. And we hear first that it is the midwives who report to the Pharaoh that the reason that there are no babies that they know of being drowned is because, well, these Hebrew women, they're remarkable. Why, they're having the children out in the field and we're never there. If you believe that, well. But now we're told the story of three women. A child is born. Now you would think that there had been no other children born to this woman, but we find out that he did have a sister. A child is born, and for 3 months, before the child's cries become too loud, and while she can still keep the infant with her at all times, she is able to keep the child in seclusion, not let anyone know about the baby. but it's becoming too dangerous.
And so this mother is determined to keep this child alive.
Now, if you think this was spontaneous, think again. There's some very careful planning in this. She apparently knows when the Pharaoh's daughter goes down to the river to bathe. Perhaps she's watched her, has some inclination of what kind of a woman this Pharaoh's daughter is. And then she creates an ark, is actually the word used. She creates a basket. She makes it waterproof. And then she instructs his sister, her daughter, to watch as she places the baby in the basket and launches it down the Nile just at the right moment when she knows the Pharaoh's daughter will be coming to bathe. And the sister is instructed to watch. The Pharaoh's daughter comes down to bathe, sees something in the rushes, instructs her maids to investigate, and finds a baby, a little tiny 3-month-old baby. She knows who it is. She knows it is a Hebrew child. She identifies it. And then the little sister. The sister comes forward, identifies herself, and volunteers her mother to nurse the child. Is the Pharaoh daughter fully aware of what's going on? Of course. The sister offers her mother, and here is a woman who has been nursing a child who volunteers to nurse this tiny baby. And so we have Moses, nursed by his own mother until he is weaned, and then adopted by the Pharaoh's daughter and raised in the Pharaoh's own household. A conspiracy of women saving a child. And in this way, God will have the vehicle needed to bring about the liberation of the Israelite people. A remarkable story of compassion and courage, audacity and wisdom. But I want to read you another story because it is a modern one with different results and yet important, I think, because it is a contrast between two baby girls. It is from a recent book called In My Father's Country, An Afghan Woman Defies Her Fate, written by Saima Wahib. She writes this: in Afghanistan, when a son is born, a tradition dictates that the father rushes into the street with a pistol and fires a few rounds into the air to celebrate. My father did this for Khalid, my elder brother, as was the Pashtun custom. A little over a year later, minutes after I was born, she writes, my father rushed outside with his weapon and did the same. His friends appeared and congratulated him on the birth of another son. My father laughed and said, oh no, my beautiful daughter was born today. But nobody celebrates the birth of a daughter with gunshots. His friends shook their heads at such eccentric behavior. You will see, he told them. I promise that my daughter will prove that she is better than many Pashtun sons and will do more for her people than 100 sons combined. When this girl was 6 years old, the Soviet Soviets invaded Afghanistan. One night, while her father was preparing a meal for his family because he loved to cook, they came to his home. He was known as a journalist who had spoken out against the invasion. They took him away, and they never saw him again. Soon it became very difficult for them to continue living, she, her mother, and her brother, and her younger sister in Kabul. So they went to live in the village with her grandfather, who protected them and took care of them until even the village became too dangerous because there were rumors that the Soviets were taking young Afghan boys into the Soviet Union away from their families. And so it was determined that the children would go to Pakistan with their mother. And she remembers the terror of traveling at night to reach Pakistan. And there she lived for several years until two uncles living in Portland, Oregon, said they would take the children and their cousins to the United States so they could go to school. They thought that Saima would become educated, become an American citizen, and go back and marry a good Afghan boy and bring him to the United States. But that isn't what happened. His daughter, whose father said she would be better than many Pashtun sons, she received her education, but she was uncomfortable living up to the expectations of her uncle. And after she was working, she left home. And at one point, volunteered to become an interpreter in Afghanistan for American forces there. She wanted to understand why it was that her father had been willing to die rather than live to see her grow up. And she tells this story. And I tell you this story because it helps us to think about mothers and children, because Saima was so lucky. But here's a different story. A 3-year-old child is badly burned by a kerosene heater given to the villagers by a well-meaning non-governmental organization, but they did not train the people in its use. They did not explain that before adding new kerosene, one needed to turn it off completely and allow it to cool. And so in this small household, a boy adds kerosene to a hot heater. It explodes, killing him and his two brothers, badly burning his little sister and his parents. They bring the little girl, not immediately but later, to a clinic at Bagram, run by the Americans. Saima is called to translate. When she arrives, she finds the little girl in terrible pain, accompanied by her angry mother. When she is finally able to translate that the little girl is in pain and they are able to give her more morphine, she begins to translate what the mother is saying. And this is what the mother says. Why are you trying to save my daughter? Why won't you show some mercy and let her die? Can you imagine what life is going to be like for her? She is going to be scarred. No one will marry her. Her brothers are now all dead. She will have more of a chance at happiness if she dies and goes to heaven. She will grow up to curse you for saving her.
Is that what you people want?
Saima writes, I couldn't think of a way to communicate to these Americans the mother's cultural logic or her love for her child or her concern or the hopelessness she must have been feeling looking at her young daughter in pain, believing that things would only get worse if she survived. The mother was taken to another room to have her equally severe burns treated. And Saima writes that she sat and held the child, and the little girl clung to her hair. When the mother returned, her anger spent, she thanked her and said that she would ask God to grant her heaven. Before you go, Saima said to her, what is your daughter's name? The mother furrowed her brow as if she didn't know what I was asking. Anjali, she replied, using the Pashto word for girl. Since so many Afghan children die in infancy, many of them are not called by their proper names until they are much older, and this Anjali was no different. Of course, this is a protective mechanism mothers have come up with, knowing that when you name a child, only to lose him or her to one of several diseases that claim thousands of young lives in Afghanistan, it is harder to get over the grief. In fact, it is not unusual for mothers to wait to start using the names of their children only when they are old enough to marry. We don't know what happened to this young girl, this three-year-old child. Later, her uncles come and take her away, but we know her parents died. It is important, I think, on this Mother's Day to think what it means to be a mother, not only here in this world, but in the wider world, and how hard it is for mothers who struggle to protect their children. How much more it makes us admire those who resist and find ways to resist against enormous odds. But even in our own world, it is not easy to be a mom. In fact, many of us, until we are moms, have no idea what it's like. Alexandra Kennedy is a psychotherapist, and she had been meditating for years, saw herself as a tranquil, together woman. Then she got pregnant. And she says, at the time of Tabor's birth, I moved into a different dimension marked by timelessness and spaciousness. But as the weeks passed, she found that she was stretched beyond all expectations. Caring for a newborn was far more time-consuming and demanding than she had anticipated, and she no longer had the luxury of uninterrupted hours. Some of you know about this. I was forced to put the awareness I had developed through meditation into instant action, washing the dishes, holding diapers, playing with the paper. These became my meditation now. But then she discovered what everyone who has been like a mother to another discovered. Being with someone so unprotected, someone who wanted 100% from me, was exceedingly painful. It forced me to look at how closed down I had been in all my other relationships. Being a mother is definitely the hardest challenge I have confronted in my life. There is no resting place. no peace to fall back on. Each phase of Tabor's life is followed by another as demanding or more so than the last. And yet, watching this robust, incredibly active child grow into a person in his own right is worth the struggle. I am coming into my own innate powers, contacting new reserves from within, because I can no longer hold myself back. Imagine what it was like to be Sima's mother. In many ways, a traditional Pashtun woman. As she watched her daughter rebel, as she came to the United States and Mumbai, her mother, and tried to adjust to living here, and then watched her daughter return to Afghanistan, to a country at war, with the many factions, knowing what she was like, and worried every moment. It is not easy to be a mom in any time or place or culture. And for all these reasons, it is good to sometimes think of God as mom. But then we come to this incredible story in the gospel, in the good news, where Jesus seems to say, oh, you think your family is just the one that you were born into? Or maybe the one in which you were adopted? You think the only mom is the one you've always called mom? Think again. Think again. There may be other women who will be like a mother to you. You may become like a mother to children that are not your own. In this new family, there will be those who are not of your kin, but you will consider them your brothers and your sisters. Because I am doing something new. Just like that child Moses was drawn out of the water and found a new mother and a new community and a new understanding that will make him a liberator of his people, so too you shall become a member of a new family that will show you what it means to live, to care, to be compassionate, courageous, and welcoming in a different world, in a new family. You shall become in this new family co-creators with God, sharing and shaping a spirituality that will allow you to grow and become fully who you were meant to be as human beings on earth. This will be a household of freedom, a community where all the walls are broken down so that God's welcome to every human being who is thirsty and hungry for justice can be made clear. Here we'll be partners with all those who are on the margins. We will participate in God's liberating work in the world. We will be rooted in a life of hospitality because everyone who comes will be welcome. We will break apart the very notion of family so that everyone becomes a member of the family. The struggle for wholeness will begin here in this new family. Now, you might remember that this whole notion of hospitality was rooted in the very idea that we are part of the body of Christ. And so, when you look at any human being, well, you're seeing Christ in every woman and child in the world, no matter what they look like, no matter how they speak, no matter what the language, they are a member of the family, they are a member of the body of Christ, they are in some way Jesus himself, because remember Jesus said, when you're hungry, when you feed the hungry, you feed me. When you welcome the homeless, you shelter me. When you give to the thirsty, you offer it to me. Perhaps you've heard the story of the Benedictine abbeys, in which every stranger was welcomed as if they were welcoming Jesus. And there was a very tired abbot. He was weary. He had welcomed thousands of strangers, pilgrims, motley strangers. At the end of the day, he's exhausted. He looks down the lane, and there's one more, and he blurts out, "Jesus Christ, is that you again?" That's the idea of family. There are no exceptions. And in fact, Oscar Romero, the archbishop who was slain, took it one step further. He said this to a congregation, a congregation of the poor and the oppressed. He said, "You are Jesus. You are Jesus. You are the embodiment of God, the hands and feet of God. You are the voice God needs now. You are Jesus." So if that's true, then there are no limits to the notion of family. Every one of us is like a mother, like a father, like a sister, like a brother to every other human being. And Meister Eckhart would say, and beyond that, to all that lives, because we are co-creators with God. We need to cultivate the richness of every kid alive. Every little boy and every little girl born wherever. We need to cultivate the extraordinary richness of what children offer us, say Patricia Williams. Because it depends neither on a mother or father alone, but it is the responsibility of every single one of us. Grandparents, friends, neighbors, the civic community across fences, across religions, across class, across town, across international boundaries. So today, we pray to a God who somehow, in some way, is like a mother. We honor all women who have been like mothers to us. But it doesn't stop there, because what Jesus says is each of us is like a mother, a father, a sister, a brother. Each of us at times is the child described by the psalmist, clinging, needing a hug, needing care, needing hope. In a family, sometimes we can be mom or dad, sister or brother. Sometimes we are that child, needing hope, needing a hug, needing encouragement. The miracle of the Christian community is supposed to be that we can be both all the time, everywhere, and no one is ever excluded from this family. So to each and every one, a happy Mother's Day.